According to the National Institute of Justice, the term hate crime was coined in the 1980s by journalists and policy advocates attempting to describe a series of incidents directed at Jews, Asians, and African Americans. The FBI defines hate crime as, quote, a criminal offense committed against a person, property, or society that is motivated in whole or in part by the offender's bias against a race, religion, disability, sexual orientation, ethnicity, or national origin. So, how do Hoosier policymakers characterize such anti-bias protections? Well, at this point, they call them pending legislation. Indiana, it turns out, is one of just 5 states without a hate crime law authorizing judges to consider bias as an aggravating factor during sentencing. Hi, I'm John Schwanis, and on this edition of Indiana Lawmakers, we'll examine the push to discourage criminal activity fueled by hate. We'll start with this legislative update from Taylor Bennett.
Indiana is one of 5 states in the country without hate crimes laws. And now for the 2nd year in a row, lawmakers are attempting to address that. 2 bills in the Indiana Senate would not create a hate crime law, but instead allow courts to impose a harsher sentence for crimes that are motivated by bias for race, sexual orientation, disability, or gender identity. An amendment added the enhanced sentencing for crimes specifically against police officers. A Marion County prosecutor, Terry Curry, is in favor of the legislation.
If someone commits a crime, whether it's battery, whether it's vandalism, whether it's murder, because of an individual's race, sexual orientation, religion, that crime is being committed against the entire community of individuals. We are making a statement as a community that this is unacceptable behavior and that we're going to deal with it more seriously than we would if it were otherwise a simple crime.
Republican Senator Susan Glick says Senate Bill 439 gives judges the power to decide if bias should be factored in a sentence.
These bias-motivated crimes are reported to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and it requires law enforcement throughout the state of Indiana to keep track and report those.
But not everyone is supporting the law. Ryan McCann of the Indiana Family Institute opposes both Senate bills.
As you look through the bill, you see certain classes of folks that get increased protections, but there are a lot of folks that get left out.
McCann says political party affiliation or supporting a certain candidate would not be protected under the legislation, and neither would someone's ideological beliefs, like being a gun rights advocate and NRA member or environmentalist with the Sierra Club. Well, you can expect this debate to continue at the State House. For Indiana Lawmakers, I'm Taylor Bennett.
Thanks, Taylor. Back in a moment with our roundtable discussion. Indiana Lawmakers, from the State House to your house.
Purdue researcher Phil Owens is creating new ways to map soil functions, improve plant growth, and increase crop yields, leading through innovation and job creation. Purdue Research Foundation. Contact innovation at prf.org.
Utter the phrase hate crime, and you're likely to get a strong reaction from everyone in earshot. That reaction, however, is by no means consistent. Supporters of hate crime provisions maintain that sentence enhancements are necessary to protect not only individuals who might be directly harmed, but also entire groups that might be intimidated. Opponents, meanwhile, argue that such measures run counter to our nation's founding principles, especially the notion that Americans are free to harbor and, in most cases, express any thoughts or opinions they desire, however odious. Is there any way to reconcile these opposing beliefs? Joining me to discuss the issue are Republican Senator John Ruckelshaus of Indianapolis, Democratic Representative Greg Porter of Indianapolis, and Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry, a second-term Democrat. I thank you all for joining us for this discussion. Let me get a handle on what is in the code, Indiana code, right now, because we often refer to Indiana as one of the 5 states with no hate crime legislation. But actually, thanks to a bill enacted, in 2000, there is reference to it in the Indiana Code, and it is defined. Is it not, Senator?
That is correct. It is defined. It is in code. But by the same token, in the environment that we're in right now, we need to go to the next step, which is truly giving judges enhancers and aggravators when the facts present themselves to be able to do what they need to do.
Because really what was there now, and has been there now, I guess, for 17 years,
right,
is simply a definition and a provision that enables law enforcement agencies, or it's not just enables them, it requires them,
right,
I guess, to report hate crimes
to the state police.
To the state police.
Right. And
that's not happening.
No, it isn't happening. It's, we wish they would have grabbed it and really reported to the state police. But I think right now, as we continue the discussion, we have to educate local law enforcement on what is potentially hate crimes, and it's an education process right now. And talking to the state police, that's what they also feel. We have to educate people, local law enforcement agencies, to what to report and how to report it.
So the fact that there hasn't been compliance, 100% compliance, that's, you're thinking, more of an issue of maybe not familiarity with the requirements or the law, as opposed to just willful ignorance of the requirement. And we should point out, I think the Associated Press did an analysis in the past year or so that showed that I think 52% of agencies in the state don't live up to that requirement. So a majority
right.
of law enforcement agencies. Anybody want to say if, speculate if it's ignorance or in willful in some manner?
Well, in my mind also, there's just sort of a fundamental contradiction there in that if we don't have something that is specifically defined and enforced as a hate crime, then the law enforcement agencies really wouldn't even be able to identify in many instances what would constitute a hate crime for purposes of the reporting requirement.
Yeah, right. Like legislation, it's like, is it a may provision or a shall provision? And, you know, I think more locals
are looking... The two most important words
most
in the Indiana
two important,
code,
right, in the code. And I think that from a local perspective, they may do that versus, they shall do it, but they just don't know how to report it, period.
And before we get into what's in the pipeline in terms of the bills that at least two of you have offered, let's look again at what's there now. We do have this definition. We do have this reporting requirement. And opponents of the bills that you have are promoting this session would say judges already can treat hate crimes or animosities that are generated by a bias of some sort. They can already factor that in. So why do we need this? How would you respond?
Well, a lot of the opponents would say, frankly, that this is creating a protected class. And it's not creating a protected class. Again, these are the individuals, if you look at the definitions, persons with disability, persons with color, persons with gender identity, these are the people in American society today that are probably under the most duress in our society. In Indiana, we are one of the five states that have not passed this legislation. The time is now.
Well, and there were... Georgia passed it, but then it was overturned
right.
By their Supreme Court, and it still has not been right. Put through again. Again, do you think that judges, do they know? Maybe this is an educational issue for them, that they've had this power for an extended period of time, that they could, in fact, factor that in as sort of a catch-all in sentencing guidelines right. in the state that are currently in state statute. Why don't they avail themselves to that?
Well, I think I'm not a judge or attorney.
You
I
can
just,
play one on TV.
I can play one. We just make laws.
But
I think the whole point with my judges, I think they use their own discretion in regards to that. We really want that aggravated part into it because that gives a prosecutor like Curry here and others and judges the ability to address a certain issue. So if we get that along with the definition, we just have to step back and just move forward again. I think it's a total education process. I think it's as we use in education, professional development, and to encourage people to look at the legislation and move it forward. But the time is now. I mean, when we've had so many, since in the last 3 or 4 months, so many instances of attacks or acts against individuals, against certain groups of individuals, Muslims, it's all type of individuals. So we need to really look at it as a state. And, the interesting part is for years, I was the only one that had bias crime legislation kind of running out there with maybe one or two other people. This year, we have like 6 or 7 pieces of bias crime legislation out there. Started with Randy Truitt last year, who's now was a representative, and then Taylor and Glick and
it did pass
House.
The Senate. We should know
right,
last,
it did.
Right. It didn't get a hearing
right.
in the House,
and it passed overwhelmingly, 34-16 last year in the Senate.
And you say the time is now. You talk about some of the studies. The Southern Poverty Law Center did an assessment, I think, in maybe the 10 weeks or so after the election, and
right.
showed a spike in all types of maybe hate crimes, at least if you want to define it in that manner. And they even looked at for those who would say that this is somehow motivated by Donald Trump's candidacy, successful candidacy, they also tracked anti-Trump hate crimes, which there were a percentage of those as well. Do you think the time is right, Terry Curry? We've seen, on the one hand, you see instances like this, and people say, oh, we need to address this and send a strong message. But we also have this sort of cultural stream or tendency, that the strong breeze that we feel blowing, that is political correctness is passé. We're moving beyond political correctness. So
not only would we say the time is right, we would say the time is overdue at this point. And getting to your question about whether the courts could consider it without regard to whether it's an explicit aggravating circumstance, that is a true statement. But the response that we've provided in regard to that argument is, if that were the case, then we would never need any explicit aggravators. And that's what we're talking about here, is when a court imposes a sentence, if it determined that it was a bias crime, that would be an aggravating circumstance that would justify the court in imposing a sentence beyond the advisory or the mid-level sentence. And we already have a number of explicit aggravating circumstances. If a child is under the age of 12, for example, or a person's over the age of 65. And so what, in our mind, what those represent are a determination by our legislature representing our state, our communities, is this is a particularly reprehensible crime, and we're giving explicit directions to the court that you can consider this in imposing a sentence beyond the advisory. So absolutely.
I should point out, and I'll play devil's advocate, because I should note to our audience, we did invite opponents and those who testified against the bill in committee, and they were unable to join us today. So it's not as if we're trying to shut anyone out of the discussion. But they would say, by identifying certain groups, whether it's those who have a different skin color or have a different religion or have a different national origin or different sexual orientation, why not, and the example they use is obesity, why not just, if there's a hate crime leveled at someone who is out of shape, or the statute currently refers to disability, I believe, but I mean, do you think that's a sort of is there any merit to that argument, or is
not in our mind, because the defined categories are immutable characteristics of the individuals, whether it's a person's race, to a certain extent their religion, and clearly in other contexts we've determined that those are protected classes, and we feel it's appropriate to define it in that way, quite honestly, from our perspective, it's kind of silly to say, well, we should protect someone if they're obese or if they're bald. This is an appropriate measure to take to protect individuals who are clearly being subjected to hate conduct. And if it rises to the level of a crime, then this is an appropriate sanction against them.
And I do want to dig into the actual legislation as it stands, as it came out of committee. But let me ask, I alluded a moment ago to the notion that this is the era, or so we're led to believe, of the backlash against political correctness. Do you hear constituents, are they saying we want hate crime legislation, or do you hear from constituents in this current climate saying, everybody's too sensitive, everybody's all thin-skinned, the chips fall where they may.
I don't hear that. I mean, I've had people call, said, the NAACP last year, they sent me over 1,200 signatures on a petition about supporting the legislation. They've asked me this year what bills are out there. I mean, we have a group of individuals that are really tracking this. Look, there's a group with the Jewish Community Relations Council, and there's 24 groups that are saying we need this legislation. No one's really, except for a small group of individuals, the detractors saying no. But if you take a survey, and I have, and we talk to people, you have groups out there from concerned clergy to NAACP to the Urban League, the Muslim Society, Islamic Society of North America. I mean, they all testify in regards to the bill. People with disabilities, Arc of Indiana. I mean, there is a push out there. People understand that we need this in the state of Indiana.
Well, I promise we jump into the bill, so let's jump into the specifics. You are, of course, co-author of the bill, Senator. It did pass out of committees, 6-3, I believe, was the vote, with some amendments, and we'll talk about those. But again, and you've already touched on why you think we need this, but tell us again, this is a the classifications or the groups that are cited are what we had already in statute with the addition, of maybe gender identity.
Is gender identity is included in this. Again, the usual people that we normally have, which is race, religious origin, et cetera, persons with disabilities. The one class that we did put in and amend into the bill was public safety officers, which would be police officers, firefighters, et cetera.
Which I think maybe state of Texas, it might have been, I believe, might have been after the, some of the tragic shootings that occurred.
And that amendment took bipartisan support in, on the at the committee itself.
Does that make sense to include law enforcement?
Well, it makes sense. So you know what? When we did that this past week, I was thinking about some of the argument that was against bias crime. It was someone out of South Bend saying, well, a protected class should be police officers. Now, that argument's not there now, so we have that as in amended into that bill, and we will see how that goes forward. So I think from that perspective, it's a step in a positive direction.
And Terry Currie, I presume you have no objection to including law enforcement.
We have no objection. Actually, I think the impetus for it arose out of circumstances we've had here in Marion County, and in particular the. The way it was amended would include law enforcement officers and their families as well, or family members, and the situation we've had on a couple of occasions where individuals have shot into, in one case, a police officer's home and their marked car, another instance where they shot into the headquarters of a district headquarters here in Indianapolis, and in two of those situations, because there was no way to be able to show or prove that the defendant knew that an officer was present, the only thing that we could charge that individual with was criminal recklessness. So in this instance, because based upon the totality of the circumstances, we would know that the shots were being fired because that individual knew that at least it was a police officer property that we could utilize the aggravating circumstance in the bill.
And a lot of people, the constituents you just mentioned, Greg, are looking to this as a very important step, but I wonder when we talk about these incidents, for instance, that were chronicled after the election, and just this week, in fact, there was a student unity rally in Bloomington at IU in the wake of the distribution or posting of white supremacist flyers, and some of the things we talked about after the election were students being who may have been immigrant students being, you know, build a wall chance in their face or time to deport them. People point to this a lot of times in the same story, you know, this bad thing happened, but this legislation is moving through the General Assembly. That wouldn't help them, right? Am I right?
No, this would not help them.
That's completely off the table.
That is correct. This is focused on individuals who commit crimes above and beyond, but with the intent, because that individual is black and it's a white person, or that it's the person is a Muslim and it's a Jewish person, whatever. Or
but going up to somebody, as we saw in the school, chanting in their face, go home, build a wall. That's protected, as would be the distribution
free speech.
Of these
that's
protected
not bother
free speech.
Free speech. That,
correct.
And that's a lot of things. I think one argument was that, well, it keeps ministers from saying something in their pulpit.
Right. You don't buy it?
No, I do not. It doesn't stifle free speech anywhere or even, say, in a pulpit. So, no, it does not. This does not bother them.
What about the slippery slope argument? People say, well, look at Europe. You know, they started off with hate crime legislation, but now it's morphed into hate speech legislation, and you can't say this and you can't say that in some of the Western European countries. Do you buy any notion of a slippery slope here, Terry Currie?
No. The First Amendment would be an absolute barrier to that slippery slope, and hateful speech is hateful speech, and it's protected by the First Amendment.
Right. Well, and the other opposition that clearly has arisen is over the notion that this would grant special protection to maybe the LGBT community. And we all know that that's been a front burner issue now for a couple of years, ever since the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was enacted and the backlash against that. That's still very much a simmering issue. And the opponents, again, if they were here, I'm sure they would articulate this, the notion that this is a Trojan horse is the term they've used, that if you get this codified, this is in statute. Well, then if you want to expand the civil rights protections afforded by Indiana statute to include, say, sexual orientation and gender identity, well, then you have a basis to do it. What do you say?
Right. Well, that's an issue for another day. This is not a protected class. This is identifying these people who have been identified.
Sounds like you're giving them ammunition for the Trojan horse theory.
No, I understand that. But by the same token, what this legislation is going to do is send the message that Indiana protects and is open for all.
Do you see any way that that could be used as a... I mean, because well, I presume, let's be straight, I mean, I you presume you would support it. Expanding, for instance, civil rights protections to include those two groups I just mentioned. Would you ever see this as a crowbar, leverage that you could kind of say, well, you know, we already protect these groups. It only is fitting that we extend
No, we're going to stay on the focus on this
Why,
part
that
right
Trojan
now.
Horse,
I mean, this Trojan horse and everything, anyone can manufacture a Trojan horse. I mean, you can say what the intended, unintended consequences are anytime. But I think where we're moving right now is looking at legislation moving forward for a bill that is what it is intent for. I mean, I don't want them to use this as a fundraiser mechanism, okay? And that's what happens.
You're
going to
be disappointed,
time.
I think. I understand. That's your hope.
Yeah, I know.
I think that's part and parcel of this notion. Do you, Terry Curry, do you see any broader attempt here at some agenda that's being orchestrated that's something other than what has been articulated by these two lawmakers, in fact, who both have introduced legislation this session?
Obviously, I'm, for the most part, a spectator to the legislative process, and so I don't have firsthand knowledge.
Well, everybody's taking a pass here on this.
But, you know, from our perspective, you know, we have been part of the coalition now for 2 years that Greg alluded to, and we're doing so not because we have some ulterior motive or ultimate separate goal here. We feel that it's important that we as a state make the statement that these type of crimes, which are clearly occurring over and over and over around our country, be treated reprehensibly.
So you think, and this is to all of you, do you think that the fact that we are on the list of five, if you want to call it that, even if we may have a definition in statute and have had for 16 years, that is a mark against us in terms of public perception of people, I don't know, employers who might want to work here or the climate that they want for their employees? Have you heard that? Is that an issue?
Or? Well, not necessarily. And I don't think anyone is making a decision whether to move to Indiana if we have a bias crimes bill or not, whether it's a corporation or an individual. But by the same token, all one has to do is turn on the television today and watch across America. Since the election, there's been 800 reported incidents across this country. This country needs the rule of law, and the judges need these aggravators and these tools in the toolbox to bring order, and this is a good thing.
Although I do think some of those, I think some of those 800 are actually verbal assaults and so forth that might not fall under this.
Right. And the key is with those 800 plus, there has been more of a national conversation in regards to bias crime legislation, and there are people that are focusing on the five states that don't have it and wondering why we don't have it in the state of Indiana and those other states. So, as you know, with the demeanor of the country and what's happening and the transition of this country right now, that is what some of the issues people are focusing on, because they feel like it's being people are being excluded.
And there's a piece of legislation, and we need to wrap up probably at this point, that I doubt will prevail this session, but would create a path to civil litigation and liability for victims to seek civil penalties. Is that anything that anyone has an appetite for here? I know that has been introduced, but...
Haven't seen the legislation, but like to take a look at it. I don't know.
Oh, so you're open to that. And I guess training for law enforcement. We talked about education.
Right.
That, too, is an issue.
It's a big issue.
Right. All right. Well, I'm going to be on somebody's bad list if I don't wrap up this conversation now. Unfortunately, always too short on time, I'm afraid, for discussions is important in this. I appreciate all of you coming and sharing your perspectives today. Again, my guests have been Republican Senator John Ruckelshaus of Indianapolis, Democratic Representative Greg Porter of Indianapolis, and Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry. 44 years since Roe v. Wade, and abortion has never left the national discussion. How things are heating up in Indiana on the next Indiana Lawmakers. And time now for our weekly conversation with Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of the newsletter Indiana Legislative Insight. Ed, is this debate what it seems to be, or as some suggest, is there some ulterior motive or some agenda here that's lurking below the surface?
Well, I think that when you deal with bias crimes and you're looking at thought crimes, obviously, you know, there is something else to think about here. But there are a lot of different nuances to it, and we saw it go through the Senate fairly easily last year and stall in the House, didn't get a hearing. And, you know, that may be the same case this year. You know, there is more of an imperative, it seems. It's a lot like the whole LGBT discrimination issue where, you know, each year you kind of change the societal attitudes a little bit more toward it, and legislators start thinking, okay, yeah, now I need to start, you know, going in that direction as well, too. But you can even look at the fact that John Ruckelshaus is one of the authors of this bill, because John represents a district where the person that he replaced was opposed to the bill last year. He voted against it last year, the person that used to hold that seat. So you can see some kind of change in attitudes to a certain extent anyway.
And for those who favor three-tier chess, where there's a lot of intrigue, they might say people are advocating this as a sort of to assuage the animosity or frustration of people who are not seeing the civil rights protection more broadly expanded to include sexual orientation and gender identity. Well, anything to that?
You can say that, and you can also make the point that this is the largest crusade potentially for the Christian evangelical community this year to oppose the bias crimes bill, because they don't have the LGBT civil rights bill, or they don't have major abortion legislation, although I guess we did see this week the first bit of legislation in that area start to move. But, you know, this is important for them, and they will be a big opposing force should it get to the House.
And I know we might want to talk about another issue, but does this pass this session?
I think it passes the Senate, and the prospects in the House are pretty murky again.
And there were some other things in other news, you might say, you wanted to mention.
Well, we had talked earlier in the session about the roads bill, and obviously that's a big work in progress. But it was very interesting this week to see that Representative Tim Brown, who chairs the Ways and Means Committee, changed his philosophy on the use of the sales tax on gasoline. And initially it was going to be phased out of the general fund and back into the actual roads and transportation use over a period of years. And now he's looking at directing that immediately toward the roads.
An immediate connection where...
Yeah, and this is something that I think that has been generated by public debate and what they're hearing from residents, their own constituents back home.
Interesting issue. Thank you always.
Yeah, and they've got a lot to backfill there as a result.
That's certainly true. We may have to talk about that again in coming weeks, and we look forward to hearing from you at that point. Thanks, Ed. For more information, episode streams, and other extra content, visit us on the web at wfyi.org/lawmakers. You can access live streaming coverage of the General Assembly on the Internet as well. And remember, you can get our show on demand from Xfinity. Well, that concludes another edition of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Schwanis, and on behalf of WFYI Public Media, Indiana's other public broadcasting stations, and my colleagues Ed Feigenbaum and Taylor Bennett, I thank you for joining us, and I invite you to visit WFYI.org for more State House coverage. Until next week, take care.
Purdue researchers are advancing manufacturing industries by developing 3D additive methods, leading through innovation and job creation. Purdue Research Foundation. Contact innovation at prf.org.